currently own 29 businesses. Now a dozen of those are related to the pest control company. We have a marketing, which comes from Dan Martell's book, Buy Back Your Time. Is he said 80% done by somebody else is better than 100% done by you. And I've kind of lived by that principle.
You're the right person to come and lead, you know, one of your 28.
It's a really, really difficult process.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Raw Selection Private Equity Podcast. Joining us today is a little bit of a wild card. It's Alan Draper, founder of Proof Pest Control and 27 other businesses that he still currently runs today. Now, this is a little bit different because Alan's not from private equity. The reason I've brought him on, if you listen to this podcast, you will know exactly why. There is a ton of information for private equity investors on how do you approach people like Alan to buy their business, but also as if you're a C-suite executive, how do you improve your passion, your drive, how you communicate with your team to be like a founder, owner of a business, and have that level of energy and drive that goes into a growing and scaling a business. Plus a ton of business advice for a business that's scaled from absolutely nothing to 13, 14 locations in the pest control industry. So buckle up, it's a little bit different, but there's an absolute ton of value here, and Alan is passionate as hell about his business and how he operates. So again, as always, thank you very much for listening and enjoy this slightly different podcast on the Private Equity Podcast. So Alan, if you could give us a 60 to 90 second breakdown of you, please.
Yeah, you know, I tell people that professionally speaking, that I was put on this planet to help others make short-term sacrifices to build their businesses and wealth. So over the last decade or so, I've been very active in the startup world. I started with a pest control company and now currently own 29 businesses. Now a dozen of those are related to the pest control company. We have a marketing business related to it. I own a digital marketing company, I own a contact marketing company. I practiced law before I got into entrepreneurship. So I'm a named partner in a law firm. I own a software company, own several real estate holding companies. So, I do quite a bit, but ultimately, I'm a business coach. But ultimately I feel like my purpose is helping people, scale their wealth in their businesses.
Okay. Interesting. So a lot going on there. What inspired you to have so many businesses? I think you said 20, did you say 26, 28 companies?
Yeah, something like that.
A private equity investor in yourself, really. What inspired all of that? That's a lot to take on.
You know, I don't think I realized when I started my first company that I would end up here, but when I started my first company, I remember cash was tight, things were difficult. And, you know, we're 6 months into this pest control company, which is very service and labor heavy. And I remember thinking, oh, I can't wait to get out of this phase. I can't wait till, you know, I have operators and, you know, there's no cash isn't tight and all those things. And the interesting thing, Alex, is that as soon as I got to that point, I started another company. And it's like, and then I reminded myself, I'm like, wait, what was it? Because I told, you know, I was saying that I couldn't wait to get out of this phase. And then I just jumped right back into it. And I realized, Alex, that the reason why I love the startup process so much is because it's so difficult. And that's the process where I'm growing and learning. So I love startups because they're so challenging, because there's so much unknown, that there's so much risk. And, I just enjoy the process of growing something without, you know, knowing exactly what's going to happen. I love the adventure that's involved in that. And so since then I've been advising startups. I've consulted over 200 companies, on an informal basis, through the process. And I love those early days because, if you talk to an entrepreneur, somebody that's been down the road a year or two or 10 or 15, we love talking about the early days. which is, it's kind of ironic if you think about it, but we love those early days because that's when we're growing.
That's really interesting. What, so you've started these businesses, you love the initial phase. Have you then, I mean, I'm going to guess you're not chief exec and running day to day of every of these companies, but have you then brought on people to then run those organizations and find them? Because that's quite difficult.
Exactly. So one of the things that I feel like I'm really good at is finding people that are passionate about what they do, that care about what they do, and just continuing to replace myself. So because I was an attorney before I started my first pest control company, I didn't feel this addiction to continue to work within a pest control company like a lot of folks do. Michael Gerber talks about this a lot in the E-Myth. You know, he tells a story of a baker about how she was the best baker in town and she wanted to hang a shingle. So she did that. And then she realized she didn't spend much of her time baking anymore. And she wanted to get back to that. But if you're a technician within your business, it's really hard to scale it. Fortunately for me, I never had a real career in the pest control industry before starting a company. And so that, I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword, but because I was fairly new to it, I didn't have this affinity to staying within the day-to-day like a lot of folks have. A lot of folks love the technical work of a business, but because I came from the outside, it was like, hey, this is our perspective. You know, I'm going to hire my replacement within the first week of our startup. And I've continued to do that. And it's gone quite well for us. But it's hard for entrepreneurs to do that for a couple of reasons. The number one reason, Alex, is because it's hard to let go of control. You know, as business owners, we put our blood, sweat, and tears into these companies, especially early on. You know, we sacrifice time with our family, we sacrifice money, we sacrifice all these things. And so for us to say, all right, I'm going to hand the reins to somebody else, it's really difficult. A lot of entrepreneurs say, you know, no one's going to care like I do. And, you know, one saying that I live by, which comes from Dan Martell's book, Buy Back Your Time, is he said 80% done by somebody else is better than 100% done by you. And I've kind of lived by that principle.
I think I could take some lessons from that myself, Alan. So I appreciate that. Sorry to interrupt. Just a quick mention of a longstanding partnership with Grata. As you will probably know, the private equity scene is constantly evolving. And deal flow is moving now to proprietary and data-driven processes. Grata provides you with the data and information of over 7 million private companies. So if you're looking to improve your proprietary deal flow and improve the data access, then reach out to Grata today. Now back to the podcast. So you mentioned about hiring these executives. Now, private equity firms are out there. They're trying to hire. They utilize people like me. They make mistakes in those appointments. You mentioned you look for people with a certain energy, a certain passion. How do you identify that within a chief executive to go, you're the right person to come and lead, you know, one of your 28?
It's a really, really difficult process. And I say that some of my biggest mistakes in business involves the folks that I've hired. And some of my greatest achievements involve the folks that I hired. And so it's, you know, I wish I had a proven bulletproof pattern. There's a few things that I do. I talk about vision of the company, and I don't talk about where the company is today. Although some of my companies have experienced some really great success, I talk about where we're headed, and I try to get a feel for how on board a leader, especially if you're talking an executive type, how on board they are with that vision. Can I tell if it lights them up? And you know, what's funny is that I just hired a new executive for Proof Pest Control. And it took me about, you know, 8 to 10 months to find this individual. And we're in the early stages. We're less than a month in. And so far, so good. But, you know, time is going to be the true test. But I think if you talk about your core values, but not in this cheesy, like, you know, archaic or mechanical way, but you talk about your core values and you actually live them. You talk about the vision of the company, and you try to align interests. You know, one of my favorite authors and speakers is Simon Sinek. And he talks about how if people, you know, if you hire somebody to do a job, they'll work for your money. But if you hire somebody that believes what you believe, they'll work for you with their blood, sweat, and tears. And so that's what we try to do. Now, I'm not perfect at it, and I've made some big mistakes, but it's very cliche to say, but it's something I try to live by. And that is slow to hire, quick to fire. You have to be able to make, you know, admit that you made a mistake. And get the folks outside of your company that aren't on board with the long-term vision.
Love that. And you're in a position where you're coaching and mentoring your executives within your companies. What advice would you be giving? Like, you'll have somebody that you think, yeah, this person's the absolute superstar within your group of organizations. What advice would you be giving to executives that are listening, chief exec, CFO, COO, to ignite that touch paper and improve and be better based on all the different executives that you've hired, brought into the business, and your own experience of leading these businesses and being so emotionally attached, which, you know, when you found a business as I have, it is difficult to let go, and you do become so wanting perfection.
You know, so if I to give advice to an executive that's leading a decent sized company, I think I would start with transparency and vulnerability, which it's not common. A lot of times the leader feels like they can't make mistakes. And I want to be clear on this, because during tough times, every company needs a really strong leader, a leader that shows, that exudes confidence, and that, you know, that individuals believe in. But that's not the same as a leader that acts like they're always right or doesn't admit when they're wrong. You know, Netflix is a great example, because they've had such great leadership from the beginning. And one of the things that they've built that company on is transparency and feedback from employees. And I always say that if you take care of your people are going to take care of your customers or your clients, and your customers and clients are going to take care of you. So if I'm giving advice to an executive, it's be vulnerable, admit mistakes, ask for feedback from your people. It's a two-way street when you're doing reviews. You're providing feedback to them, and they're providing feedback to you, which for a lot of leaders, that's a tough concept to accept. And, you know, if you get your people right, and it's cliche, it gets thrown around a lot, people don't actually, you know, do what they say, but if you take care of your people, then your organization is going to take care of themselves. I like to say that, you know, when I see something in my company, whether it's a new design or a new department or a new marketing campaign, whatever it is, that I didn't have anything to do with creating, those are my proudest moments, because I'm seeing people that buy into the company. In order to get that buy-in, you have to trust your people. You have to hire them to do a job and let them do it. Leaders have a hard time with that. But if I hire somebody to do a job and I tell them how to do it, or if I just do it for them, one of the two of us is unnecessary.
I absolutely love that. And I think there's a little bit there for me as well as we scale the business here. That's really insightful. So to move on to the business, one of the main businesses that you founded, or one of the first, I'm not sure, but which is the Proof Pest Control business. Now, looking at things, founded this with your brother, hell of a story, grown this business now, what looks like 13 locations, if I can count correctly, on the website. Talk us through a little bit of the journey there. You both went into pest control, you went into law, came back, went for it again, founded this organization, and clearly have grown it to now a business that's not just in, you know, three states, but multiple states across the US. You're kind of spanning right across East Coast to West Coast. Talk to us a little bit as a founder of that business, to scale that business, that journey.
Yeah, you got it exactly right. Started with my brother. And it wasn't, to be honest with you, and this isn't always noticeable from my social media or the information out there, but the first time we started a pest control company, we failed. We couldn't get it off the ground. I felt like we, you know, too immature. We couldn't get along. We didn't have enough capital. And then I decided to go to law school. He kind of stuck within the pest control industry. I graduated. I practiced law for a while. And then there was this opportunity for us to give it another shot. And that was in 2014. And, you know, I was practicing law at the time in Phoenix, Arizona. And I had a well-paying job. I had a 2-year-old and a 4-month-old. And I remember coming home one day from my my law firm job. And I told my wife, hey, yeah, I'm thinking about quitting the law. She's like, okay. I said, and I think I'm going to start a pest control company. She's like, okay. And then I said, and we're going to move from Phoenix to Detroit, Michigan to do it. And she's like, okay. Like, you know, and, you know, she looks at me and she said, you know, I believe in you. Let's do it. And so we, you know, pack our belongings, our small children into our, you know, 4-door sedan and make the hike out to Detroit, Michigan. And, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. We've been able to scale it. We're in 7 states. We do have 13 or 14 locations. And we're getting into the acquisition game. And, you know, I think for us, the ability to scale proof just came down to this concept of what our vision was for the company. And it was exactly that. We were good at marketing and sales. And so we, as leaders of the company, as owners, we hired people to fill in the gaps. And we've hired some really great leaders. And the great folks that we have hired at Proof over the last decade have outweighed the folks that we had to let go or weren't a good fit for us. So, you know, Alex, I think just in the beginning, we crafted this vision. And it hasn't gone perfectly by any stretch of the imagination. We've, you know, we've gone off on side roads. We've tried things that didn't work. We've made mistakes. We've lost business partners, all these things. But we always had this vision of, hey, we're not just going to sit on our hands. We're going to find opportunities to scale. And we've done that.
Congratulations for you. And you mentioned you're going down the acquisition trail. Is that something you've already explored, or is that something that is new and these 13 locations are all organic?
So we've supplemented some of our locations with a few small acquisitions. We have, but every new location that we've opened, we've done that organically through door-to-door marketing and then digital and online marketing. So we've not gone into a new market with acquisitions. And I think we're going to continue that path where we're going to do larger and larger acquisitions, but within the markets we already have.
So that's interesting, because private equity would do the opposite. They'd make the acquisition and then likely drive into it. They'd like to do the organic stuff, but I don't see that executed as well. What's leading you down that path rather than we'll go and buy a business and then build on the back of it?
It's our financial model. So in the locations where we're already located, we've developed very strong brands. We have thousands upon thousands of 5-star reviews. And within a service company, that means a lot. If people haven't heard of us within a market, the very first thing they're going to do is go online and see our presence, see what other people are saying about us. And so we've developed a really strong brand name. And just for what we're trying to do with the company over the next 3 to 5 years and how we're trying to scale it, we're going to be bringing acquisitions under our umbrella versus going out into new markets and relying on a brand name that already exists there. For us, the acquisitions are more seamless doing that, although we still have our struggles with them. And it just fits with where, again, we're trying to be in the next 3 to 5 years, just keeping them under the Proof name and brand.
So you mentioned building that brand, which is, I believe, underrated in any industry. How have you, what have you done to build that? Because something new is scary for anybody. If I came to you and tried to sell you my J phone, you'd be like, I've never heard of it. Why would I use that? Service is a little bit different, but certainly that brand and recognition and reassurance you have now, how did you build that at the start?
You know, brand is such an interesting concept because I think in a lot of ways, building a brand is synonymous with having faith in your business, because you don't see immediate returns, and it costs a lot of resources, takes a lot of time, and costs a lot of money. And what I mean by that is you have to have touch points over years and years and years with thousands upon thousands upon tens of thousands of people. So it's a slow moving kind of, you know, it's like the snowball effect, and it takes a lot to get it going. But once you do that, once you have a few years under your belt and you have this proven track record of taking care of people, then it just gains momentum and requires less and less effort to scale even bigger and bigger. And with a service company specifically, you're building two brands. You're building a brand with the folks on the outside of the company, customers and prospective customers. Then you're also building a brand with folks on the inside of the company. And in both situations, what it comes down to, what brand really comes down to, is are they going to do what they say they're going to do, right? So it's like, if you think of McDonald's, it's a very, very strong brand, regardless of how you feel about their actual product. You know, I've been to McDonald's in the United States. I've been to McDonald's in Italy. I've been to McDonald's in Chile in South America. And the French fries taste the same. And it's unbelievable, right? It's like, how do they do that? And all they're doing is they're providing what they say they're going to provide. They're providing that consistency. And it's such a powerful thing, but it takes faith. Because I can spend money, Alex, on a pay-per-click campaign. As soon as that thing goes live, kind of gets out of its learning phase, my phone's going to start ringing. With brand, it's not like that. It takes time, and brand's really tough to track. It's really tough to monetize. So it requires, hey, you know, I believe in us. I believe in our systems. And so this thing's going to work over time, and we're going to put in the, you know, the resources to make sure that it does.
So what's the two biggest challenges that you've faced with Proof Pest Control, and how have you overcome them?
So I look at, especially in business and in life generally, as your opportunities are going to be found where your challenges are. So my greatest opportunities, if you had just changed the word challenges to opportunities, my answer is going to be the same. And that's number one with my business partners, and number two with our personnel. I love the saying, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go with someone else, right? And that's one of my personal core values, is take someone with you. That being said, a partnership's a lot like a marriage. You know, there's this honeymoon phase when it's exciting and it's new and everything seems perfect. And then you get a few years down the road and you're like, this is hard work. And so when I look for a partner, the number one attribute that I look for, it's not what are their resources, it's not their experience, it's not their intelligence. It's, is this individual likely to wake up after a really hard day and just start like it's day one? Just start with that same type of renewed vigor. And if you find that in a business partner, because that's what business is. Business is getting punched in the face over and over and over and just starting again like it's your first day. And it's really, really hard to do. And it's very understated in media, especially social media. People glamorize business and make it sound like it's just, you're just going to the bank all day. So that's my number one challenge, is finding partners that have that consistency. I currently have 21 business partners, and that doesn't include the 10 or so that I'm no longer business partners with. So number one challenge is finding and keeping really good partners. The second is individuals, is finding people, like we spoke about before, that you share a common vision with, that believe what you believe and that are working for more than just dollars and cents. You know, what's funny, Alex, is that people, there was a survey done about a decade ago and they asked people, hey, what's your number one motivation for work? What is the motivation that is most likely to increase your desire to produce high results? And as you can imagine, everybody said, number one is money. Then they crafted a study where they weren't asking the people, they were actually testing them. They changed different variables. They added different things to find out what was actually changing their motivation and their likelihood of producing results. And they found out that money wasn't number one. Money wasn't number two. It was either third or fourth. I can't remember. But the number one reason that people worked at a high degree, that were very motivated, that were able to perform at a very high degree, was working together to achieve a common goal. In other words, they were working, you know, for an owner or an entrepreneur or a leader that believed what they believed. And so they shared that. So number one challenge, finding and retaining really good partners. Number two challenge, finding and retaining top level employees.
Not only am I the host of the Private Equity Podcast, but I'm also the founder and managing partner of Raw Selection. Raw Selection is a private equity specialist executive search firm with two divisions, one that focuses on portfolio C-suite executive hires, and one that focuses on private equity direct hires of your back office and investment deal professionals, operating across Europe and North America. A unique offering of our service is that we offer a full money-back guarantee on all upfront deposits. We typically take around $10,000 as an upfront deposit to commence the search process. The remainder is then on completion, but that upfront deposit is completely refundable. If you're not happy with our service, we will refund that upfront deposit, no questions asked.
So it could be a bit of a different question this, Alan, but so I've got a process running, a search running at the moment with a chief executive who's a founder of the business, and he founded the organization, sold to private equity, and he's going again. Most of them clock out and leave after 6 months. This guy's going to the stars and the moons. And executives love to work with people like that because they're exactly how you're exuding yourself at the moment, highly passionate, involved in every element of the business, care about whether the cleaner thinks the business is great or the chief financial officer thinks the business is great. Now, you're managing CEOs that aren't founders of the business. What advice would you give to a chief exec to say, how can they be more passionate and be more like an owner or founder of that business than a chief executive, to give out what you're giving us, which is incredibly engaging, incredibly passionate? And I can guess there's a lot of people who want to work for people like that, or at least I know because I interview people like that all the time. Whether you're a CFO, CEO, COO, senior manager, whatever it is, how can they engage and communicate and demonstrate the passion that you're demonstrating here?
I think there's a couple of things. So first, the individual executive has to align their interests with the company. So there has to be this level of additional success by the, you know, that's received by the executive when the company succeeds. And there's lots of ways to do that. The other thing that I think needs to be in place is this system of accountability and autonomy. It's really hard for people to get buy-in, even an executive, if that executive doesn't have the authority to make decisions and be supported by a board of directors, by an owner, by a founder, whatever the case is. So they have to be in this position of, hey, I'm going to be able to make decisions. I'm going to be able to do what I think is best for the company and execute on that. And then I think the third piece would be, there has to be this recognition of achievement occasionally. It's lonely at the top. And that's not an excuse. It's said all the time, but it's not an excuse, because as individuals, we don't like being alone. there was this long-term, I think it was like 90-year study done by Harvard. The results came out within the last couple of years about happiness. And they found out that at the end of the day, which this isn't surprising at all, but it was kind of cool to hear and be reinforced. At the end of the day, when people, you know, are on their deathbeds, those that lived a happy life had really good relationships with people. So as an executive, it's kind of funny because we live in this mixed world of, hey, I got to lead my people. I have to be stern and serious. And I have to make sure they're held accountable and there's discipline when there needs to be and all that. And I get that. I understand that. You can't allow mediocrity to be involved in your business. I understand that. But then there's this other side of, you know, I have to make sure my people know that I care about them and that there's a relationship. Now, this doesn't have to be a, we go hang out on the weekends relationship. I'm not that guy. I'm friends with my business partners. But it's not that type of relationship, and it doesn't have to be. But I think with those three things, you know, I think if the CEO or an executive aligns interest with the company, there's this shared interest of, you know, the vision, and there's this opportunity for folks to to be celebrated. I think that's a recipe for success for any leader.
Perfect. I'm going to ask you a bit of a curveball here. Before we hit record, Alan, you said that you get approached by private equity firms on a regular basis with regards to your businesses. Now, one of the hard parts for private equity firms is deal origination and engaging on a proprietary basis with people like yourself. Now, has there been any really good approaches you've seen? Is there any recommendations that you would give? And this isn't endorsing everyone just to reach out to Alan and try and get his companies or his pest control business or anything like that. But what would you advise to private equity firms to say, guys, if you're going to approach people like me, I've had this before, or this has been my recommendation, don't just shoot me an email and then batter me with calls for the next 2 weeks and then never hear from you again. I don't know what your experience has been, but if you could give us a bit of an insight to that, I know there's many listeners that would want to learn from that.
Yeah. So I remember when I first received my first email, which was, I think it was our first year in operation.
Okay.
And this company was like, yeah, hey, I, private equity, I want to buy your business. And I remember like thinking like, oh my gosh, someone wants to buy my business. Right. And we were doing less than $1 million in revenue. We did less than $1 million our first year, but then by year two, we were well north of $1 million in revenue. So just so that you know our relative size. But then the emails continued to come, and I think I've received three today. And I have an executive assistant that helps with my emails, but I still see them every once in a while. And they're just I can tell that they're casting a really wide net. And those are all going to just be deleted if they even get to me. So that's how not to do it. But from the marketing side, like I get it. I get that there's like different touch points and they're going to have those where it's like, hey, we're going to send like 5,000 of these emails out. See if we, you know, there's some low hanging fruit there. I get that, but that would never work with me. Now on the flip side of that, I had somebody, I can't remember how he got me on the phone. I can't remember, but there was some tactic in order to get me on the phone. It had to be something genuine. It felt very specific. But when he did get me on the phone, what he was really good at was somehow he knew what I personally wanted to do and what my partners and I wanted to do with Proof and what our vision was. And that's not on any website. My guess is that he made an assumption, but he knew our history. He was able to talk to me about what happened at Proof 8 or 9 years ago. And then he was able to match what he was doing and what the vision of that PE firm and that acquisition would have been with what we were trying to do at Proof. It was fantastic. I talked to him a couple of times, even though I was just interested in the conversation. We had no intent to exit, but it was such an impressive conversation because, and we try to do the same thing when we're buying companies, where it's like, let's not talk about what we want. Let's try to find out what the company that we're acquiring, what do they want? And for a lot of pest control companies, this is a blue collar industry. Okay. A lot of owners spent time one-on-one with customers, especially in the early days, one-on-one where my face and my voice was at their house and we were talking face to face. We want to feel like there's something to our legacy. It's not just about dollars and cents, although that's a big chunk of it. So, but each person is different, but a lot of it, this is going to be a step in the right direction for anybody that's listening. If you convince a potential seller that their customers are going to be taken care of, and it's very hard to do, especially for smaller organizations, but if you can convince them of that, that there's going to be this continuity of service, and they're going to feel like, hey, I didn't sell my customers out. That's a very common theme in any type of service industry. Is it like, hey, am I just selling my customer list and dumping them? If there's something there where it's like, hey, these folks, and by the way, it shouldn't just be, that shouldn't just be like something that's practiced in terms of like, hey, I'm just saying that. Because in a recurring service industry like ours, like pest control, the way to make money is by keeping your customers. That's one of the best advantages of a service industry is like, hey, I don't have to start over at a restaurant. That customer may never come back. But if you have that, you have that perspective of like, hey, I know this is your legacy and I know you care about this. And I want to be able to call you John or, Jim or whoever in 5 years and report that your longest standing customers are still with us and they just left us a 5-star review. I think that's going to really resonate.
Well, I appreciate sharing that. Bit of a left field question, but definitely important for the listeners. You've quoted a few books, you've quoted a few references, you've quoted a few studies from Harvard, etc. Clearly well read. What influences do you read, do you watch, do you listen to that you recommend others check out? And I know you're a fellow podcaster, so please feel free to reference your podcast.
Yeah, so I have a list of my 10 favorite business books. I talk a lot about business and, building businesses and building wealth. And so I have a list of my top 10 money books. So you can check out my website, alandraper.com. I have that on there, links to my podcasts. I'm very active on Instagram and I'm at Real Alan Draper. But, just off the top of my head, some of my favorite books, Good to Great by Jim Collins is definitely up there for those that are trying to understand what the difference is between your average good companies and the ones that really excel. A lot of the principles that I've talked about today are in that book. One of my favorite money books is by Robert Kiyosaki. A lot of people like Rich Dad Poor Dad, which I do, but a game-changing book is called The Cash Flow Quadrant. It just changes the way that you think about managing money and entrepreneurship and leveraging your time. So that's kind of a couple recommendations, but I'm constantly posting and talking about the influences and mentors in my life through my social media and on my website.
Appreciate that. Thanks for those recommendations. And is the best place for anybody to reach out to you, is that via your website?
Yeah, my website, my Instagram, I'm pretty easy to get a hold of. And, I do this thing where I feel like I've been blessed over the years. I think when you've done it long enough, you realize that there's this element of whether you call it luck or inspiration or blessings or whatever you want to call it. And I feel like the more that I give to others, the more that I get of that. And so I do free 15-minute calls with any type of entrepreneur, regardless of the stage that they're at. And so I'm happy to schedule those through my executive assistant. I'm an angel investor, so I've invested in a bunch of companies over the years, if they're the right fit. But I like to extend that offer. People can reach out to me and schedule a call, and there's no strings attached. It's just I like hearing people's business stories, and I have a passion for it.
I'm sure you'll get a few reach outs from this, Alan. Well, thank you very much for sharing everything you have. It's a bit different from the Private Equity Podcast, but definitely something I think we all needed to hear, and certainly me personally, in scanning Raw Selection. So thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And as always, to our listeners, thank you very much for you guys for joining us. Should you ever need support with private equity professional hiring or portfolio executives, please do reach out to us at Raw Selection. But till the next time, keep smashing it. And thank you very much for listening.